You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter at a bright, beautiful Davis day. It's not sunny, but it's bright out there, Don.
It's what the Weather Service calls partly sunny, which is an improvement over what we've been having for the last week or so, which was mostly cloudy. It is Wednesday, March 6th, 2024, as Lois and I are recording this for broadcast on March 7th. And today's high is going to be 62 degrees, which is also an improvement, I have to say. Today, partly sunny with a slight chance of thunderstorms, partly cloudy tonight with a low of 43 degrees. Just want to note, we got into the upper 30s a couple days ago at night. What? Tomatoes, you said? Thursday will be becoming sunny. I love that. 63 degrees. Thursday night, 40 degrees and clear. Friday, sunny. I don't think I've seen that on the National Weather Service forecast for the Sacramento Valley for like 3 weeks. Sunny. And it will be 66 degrees on Friday. Enjoy it while you can, because Friday night will be mostly clear, 43 degrees. Saturday will be partly sunny, 62 degrees. Saturday night will be partly cloudy, 43 degrees. Sunday will be partly sunny, 61 degrees. Monday, chance of showers, 61 degrees. Monday night, slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, low around 47. Tuesday, chance of showers, partly sunny with a high near 63. There's been
it
some.
Sounds like a typical March in Davis.
Yeah, it's been pretty.
We're down. We're over. We're out.
Most of the country was following along with our weather during the last week because we had an epic snowstorm that dumped in one area. I think it was Soda Springs, 12 feet of snow.
Wow.
10 feet of snow in some other areas, 8 feet in other areas. I-80 was closed for a couple of days up in Donner Pass. We had an amazing amount of snowfall. We went from 23% of average on the 1st of January to 104% of average day before yesterday. So we've caught up on snowfall across the entire Sierra Nevada range, and we've got, it looks like, a little bit more coming in. I've been curious about this extended discussion because there's been some mixed results from the models, as they say, the Sunday through Wednesday. Are we going to get some more rain? Well, there are several short wave troughs, which are storms, coming through interior Northern California Sunday through Tuesday, bringing a threat of light to moderate precipitation. Not much. The highest rainfall or snow is going to be over Shasta, Western Plumas County Mountains, North Sierra Nevada. Storm totals for the Central Valley look very light, from less than a tenth of an inch in the San Joaquin Valley to maybe half an inch in the Northern Sacramento Valley. So just like the last few days for us, these storms moving over fairly quickly and fairly cold, very little rain coming down, except here and there, suddenly it'll open up and we'll have perhaps some thunderstorms. Here's the key thing for gardeners out there that have been waiting to get out and do something. Drier weather expected midweek as upper ridging becomes the dominant feature. So a little bit more rain, few more storms coming in Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday on, you might actually be able to get out and do some gardening. It's been a little frustrating for gardeners. This is kind of funny. One of the local hardware stores is now stocking tomato plants. Of course they are. And someone asked me why, and I want to say, I don't know, you'd have to ask their buyer. But the reason
it's not time for tomatoes.
It's time for the people who buy tomatoes early to plant them up in bigger pots and start collecting their plants and protecting them. It's too cold at night for them to be outside. Low 40s are not optimal. Upper 30s are definitely not good. As a retailer, I mean, I got a list from one of my growers with 42 varieties of tomatoes on it, ready to go, ready to send out. And I have to give this grower credit. It says in the comments, need protection, exclamation mark. So they're doing their part. And I hope that the retailers who are bringing them in are putting them in sheltered locations where it stays a bit warmer at night. Because what happens if we bring in tomatoes now, and they're right out in the open, the soil gets very cold. We were 37, 38 degrees the other morning, and even low 40s is going to be coming on. And they discolor. They get kind of purple.
They turn purple and shiver.
Yeah, well, all of my customers are walking and wearing overcoats. And then, you know, every now and then one will say, when are you going to have tomatoes? And I feel like saying, when the majority of people in here aren't wearing overcoats. How's that? Is a good metric.
When you've got shorts and a short sleeve shirt.
Yeah, well, in Davis, you know, there's always someone wearing shorts and a short sleeve shirt.
That's
but
true.
When the majority of people are wearing shorts and a short sleeve shirt, not just the college guys. But we wanted to see temperatures closer to 50 at night. And I mean, consistently before we even bring them into our garden center. We have some in our little greenhouse, which provides a few degrees of protection. So, you know, if you really, really want them, I guess we'll go in there and get some for you. But it frustrates me because what happens when they come in early is they discolor. It's a phosphorus deficiency. It's not correctable. It's because the roots are cold. They can't take up nutrients. It sets them back. We know that cold exposure sets them back several days with each incident of exposure. So there's really no particular advantage, except if there's that one variety and you don't think you're going to be able to get it somewhere else and you see it, you're just like me, you're going to buy it because you want that one and you're going to take it home and you're going to set it in a sheltered location, right? That's what you're going to do. And you're not going to plant it out, we hope, until about the third week of April would be the time we typically plant tomatoes out in the garden.
So you'd put it on your back porch where everything is really sheltered, right next to that little fox that you have that's trying to adopt you.
Yes, I was telling Lois before we came on that one of the foxes that has been coming up to the back door now just casually strolls into my backyard when I'm out there late at night looking for snails and slugs and just looks at me 10 feet away. Doesn't seem to be concerned
Uncle
at all.
Don, Uncle Don.
There you go. No, I will not put food out for you. You have to feed yourself. Anyway, if you're buying these things early, be sure to find the one microclimate around your house where you can keep the little plants. If we get cold abruptly, It's not common. By mid-March, typically, we're not likely to have a frost. Our last date of frost is typically first or second week of March. And those are typically light, sparkly frost, pretty thing out in the field. Nothing to really worry about in terms of directly harming the plant. But you do have the risk anytime through the month. And it's not just frost. It's the colder night temperatures slowing the plants down. I strongly urge you not to buy peppers, not to buy eggplants, even if you see nice, healthy plants, because they're really adversely affected by cold nights and they will be there later. It's not like they're going to run out. So that's your public service announcement. If you buy them, put them in a sheltered location. Usually under the overhang facing east or south is optimal. If you have a little pop-up greenhouse, this is where they're really handy. Those little greenhouses that everybody was buying back during the pandemic because they all wanted to go into backyard gardening are season extenders. And this is how they work. You get that little tomato plant. They don't stay that warm at night. You need to understand this. They only stay a few degrees warmer at night, but that can make a difference. What happens is on any sunny day, they can be in the 80s in that greenhouse. So that makes up for some of that cold exposure. So we were in our greenhouse on a sunny afternoon at the nursery, and it was 82 degrees in there. That's helping to compensate for the fact that it was probably 40 degrees that night. On average, the plant was getting some benefit from the pop-up greenhouse. I'm always concerned that people think these are, you know, warm enough for orchids or something. No, they're season extenders. They're comparable to a cold frame in climates where people use those. Anyway, that's the
upcoming. You can make a cold frame easily if you don't want to, you know, go out and buy something. If you're handy, it's not that hard.
Usually the plastic they're using for these is like an 8 mil plastic. You know, if you're building one, go ahead and go online and find some of the heavier duty stuff. Yeah. I can tell you the thinner stuff these greenhouses are made of, our experience has been, hate to say this, these pop-up greenhouses have about a 3-year lifespan before you have to replace the cover. And frankly, big commercial greenhouses likewise are replacing the cover every couple of years. You can buy much heavier duty stuff and build a cool little greenhouse. Again, it'll make a 4 or 5 degree difference. There are times when that's sufficient, but there's also, it's not enough for tropical plants. And that's my biggest concern is people are misunderstanding what they're building.
One of the things we used to do back in Michigan, and understand a totally different climate, lots of snow and all that stuff. But what would happen is people were great reusers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not much went into the dump. You had to be really, really, really broken to go into the dump. But, you know, people would find, there's a window. It's got glass in it. It's got a window frame and it's off a house. It's just sitting there. Well, okay.
Perfectly good.
Yeah. And all you'd do is you'd lean it against something and that window, the glass would protect whatever was underneath it. And, you know, you just build the sides a little bit and then have the front leaning on the back. And hey, you've got yourself a cold frame.
A passive solar cold frame. There you go. Yeah, we have exactly. A KDRT alert. KDRT does these periodically and will tell you about events locally that you might be interested in. KDRT and Oddfellows present a screening of the film Open Country. It'll be at Oddfellows Hall, which is 2nd and D Streets in downtown Davis, Sunday, March 10th, 6 p.m. Open Country is a documentary film by local filmmakers Glenda and Jesse Drew on the history and politics of country music. The film features interviews with Billy Bragg, Hazel Dickens, John Langford, Pete Seeger, and many others, as well as archival clips and contemporary performances. This screening is a benefit for KDRT and Davis Media Access. For more information, you can go to opencountryfilm.com. To buy tickets, you can go to davismediaaccess.org, which I think I just said wrong. Hold on here. It said, you go ahead and say something and I'll get the exact address.
If you all remember Utah Phillips, who used to live in the area, he was up in Nevada City for a while. And he did concerts here in Davis. I've met him several times, took some pictures for him. And he's interviewed in this movie. They have spent a long time creating this film. I read the information about how it came to be and how it, you know, progressed. Boy, it's amazing. I am so looking forward to seeing this.
March 10th.
The film again is Open Country. And if you miss the one here, well, look for it other places because they're using this as a fundraiser for different things. I think KDVS, maybe KVMR. Yeah.
You can go to davismedia.org, okay, and you can buy tickets or you can get them at the door. So that's March 10th, Open Country Film Benefit for KDRT. Okay.
All right. So we've got a lot of questions. Now, this one came in from Nicholas in Santa Barbara, and the pictures are so sad. I mean, just... oh, so sad. But thank you for sending the pictures, as now at least we understand what's going on. So I'm going to read this. Hello, Lois and Don. On February 19th, at the end of our last big storm here, we lost a sacred and beloved 200 to 300-year-old oak tree from our front yard. She fell from atop our retaining wall and down into the street. There was just too much water for her to handle this year after too many years of drought. We loved this tree like a family member and would love to see if we can keep her legacy alive. I have consulted with local tree services about my options, and they all have differing opinions. Mm-hmm. It is worth noting that she was precariously perched on top of a retaining wall where she fell, so we were forced to cut her back to the stump to save the wall. She also took out a fence that sat on top of the retaining wall, which has to be rebuilt. So if we keep the tree, we'll have to cut it back even further to leave room for the tree to regrow between the root ball and the new fence line.
Yeah.
Now, one tree service had said the tree will never regrow, will just sit there and rot, so it's time to remove it. That's not the advice I was hoping for.
Right.
Another tree service has suggested that after cutting the tree back to a few feet above the stump, as we must, we make some top cuts to encourage suckers to grow upward from the trunk. They also suggested that I trim back any damaged roots and pack in some quality topsoil to form a large mound over the existing and exposed healthy roots. The third tree service suggested the same thing about making top cuts to encourage suckers to grow upward from the trunk, but to level the roots at the height of the stump line and to just pack in the remaining roots with topsoil so we don't end up with a 5-foot high mound of earth in our front yard peering over the street.
You're right.
It's a 3-foot mound. The last option would aesthetically be our preferred way to go, but I was hoping you could offer any input, advice, or warnings you might have about how we approach this project. How deep to cut into the trunk wood to promote growth? Is it cambium level? Is that too deep? Would diagonal cuts sloping towards the ground, away from the root ball, serve to promote upward sucker growth, or would it damage the tree further? How long can the root ball survive exposed to sun and air without being packed in earth? Thank you so much for any input you can offer. Happy to trade advice for firewood. And then the three pictures show a very large, well, a medium large tree. I'd say that there are two stems coming up, and I would guess they would probably be Bigger around than a ham.
Oh yeah, they're big. They're good diameter. Yeah. Yes, this was an old oak tree, and it is always sad when one topples over. It's interesting. The tree services are making educated guesses here. You never know if there are enough growth buds down at the base there for one of them to suddenly now be exposed to sunlight and break and grow. And you won't know probably until you get well into the growing season. I don't think that a tree where half of its roots have been uprooted is likely to ever be a healthy, full-size tree again. It could resprout. It could send up multiple shoots. You won't really know. So you can certainly try what they're suggesting, which is to make clean cuts and cut into the cambium a little bit. Cambium level is not too deep. That's exactly what you're doing. And you're trying to encourage a bud that suddenly will be hormonally in charge to sprout and grow. And it will come up and it will grow in what, if it does this, what arborists sometimes call panic growth, very, very vigorous growth. My concern is that might not be real well attached. So you might get that to grow up and might even become sort of form a new leader, but I don't know that it would be stable. So it's something that if you do that, you would definitely need to have it checked periodically to make sure this tree is not just going to become a risk in the future. A lot of your roots are exposed there and they're simply going to have to be cut off. Don't think about trying to push this back upright or anything like that. My inclination here is that this is not a tree you're likely to be able to save as a tree. If you value the plant, I guess that's the way I can put this, it could resprout. You won't know until you try it, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, and get something to grow up that will be the remnants of the 300-year-old oak tree. What I would do if it were mine, and I am very nostalgic about trees like this, is I would use those roots and that the remainder of that tree to shelter a new tree. I would get a 1 gallon size or a liner of whatever species it is, and I would put it around somewhere on the back side of those roots, and I would leave the old tree there personally. I might even plant a little vine or something like a clematis on the roots and let it become a structure. And if it resprouts, great, wonderful. It can grow compatibly with the new tree, which will get off to a great start, which you will give special attention to. And a few years down the road, excuse me, you will probably end up pruning out the tree that's fallen over because the new tree that you have planted will be taking its place. I prefer to see succession rather than a really aggressive attempt at conservation of a tree that might not work and more likely wouldn't really be all that safe in the long run. Again, realize I'm just looking at pictures. I'm not an on-site arborist and I'm not a consulting arborist in the first place, but I look at this and I think you could get it to resprout. You could probably backfill with some soil. It needs to be as close to your native soil type as possible. You could possibly even get it to grow as a oak shrub for a while, but really my inclination, this is what happens in nature. When a big tree goes down, little trees come up in the protection of the big tree that's there on the ground, and they form the replacement tree that will be there for the next 200 to 300 years. That's what I would do. Again, this is, your arborists are disagreeing, but they're all looking at the situation and trying to make the best of a less than optimal situation, to put it mildly. Suckers are not generally well attached. Suckers can become unsafe. So someone would need to monitor this carefully over many years, and I'm sure that would happen. But my guess is that you'd be better off just using that framework of the roots up in the air, if you don't mind the look of it, to protect a new little tree that'll go in right at their base. And as I say, you could plant something to scramble over the roots and make it an attractive and interesting garden feature. To me, old trees and stumps and things like that are history. There's a big stump in our backyard. We don't know what the tree was. It was probably here 200 years ago. I love that fact. I love the fact that there was a tree on our property where I still see a remnant of that. And new trees were planted 20 or 30 feet away, which are now becoming great big dominant parts of our landscape. So I would use this tree to nurture a young one. I hope that's an answer that you can work with, because my guess is that a lot of this cutting back and allowing the sucker to grow, which is fine. Go ahead and do that if you want to try that. Encourage the suckers, but plan on the replacement of that tree with a new healthy seedling.
Wow, Don, that is not at all what I was expecting you to say. Because I'm looking at this picture, the tree fell over, yep, and they cut off the main part of the trunk. So about Yeah, a third to a half of the roots are still in the ground in their original position, and then the backside is flipped up. So I was expecting you to say to dig out where the roots came out, stand the tree up, and push the same dirt back in on it.
No, I would not try to stabilize that tree. A tree of that age that's fallen over, standing it back upright, it's very likely to just fall over again in the future. Okay. Major roots have broken here. And this is what happens when they go down. So it wouldn't have the anchorage that it had before. I don't think there's any way to stand it back upright. And to their credit, the tree services are saying basically, the two that are suggesting this, try to get a new shoot to come up on the existing trunk. That's fine. Again, you can do that, but it won't be a single leader tree, more than likely. It would take a lot of work to do that. And my guess is, if it happened in nature, out in a forest, I wouldn't be concerned about it. But right here where this is, I would be concerned about the long-term stability. The biggest risk of this is you've got big open wounds, and Phytophthora rot can get into those quite readily. I don't know whether it will or will not sprout. We really won't know. So there's no urgency to this. You really won't know until you get through a growing season. But I would be concerned about a tree with that much wood and that many injuries to the root getting some kind of decay, causing it to become unstable 10 years, 20 years down the road. That's just my concern on this. I always like to think of, trees do have a lifespan. 200-300 years is a not uncommon lifespan for an oak. But what you'd be doing here is conserving something. And I think it would be better, and I get into this discussion a lot in Davis because of older trees, people are thinking of taking out to plant a new tree. For the urban forest where you are, for the street you're on, for the population of trees that's there, your very best bet is to get a new tree going nearby as soon as you can, because that will gradually replace the canopy that this tree was providing. It's really sad to lose a tree like this. I get the desire to try and conserve it. Many of the things arborists will do to conserve old historic trees are not necessarily structurally all that stable. They're doing it for historic reasons. And in this case, if it were mine, I'm just suggesting what I would do, which is make use of that wonderful old stump and those roots and put a new tree nearby that'll be nurtured near them and will gradually replace that tree.
So the roots that are in the air are never going to be useful to the tree, even if the tree resprouted, because they're up in the air.
Yep.
Would you maybe cut those off?
No, I'd plant a clematis on them. That's what I would do.
Yeah, I heard that the first time. And then looking at the picture, there are two main trunks that were on this tree that have been cut back, but it looks like it's way over by the fence. Wouldn't we cut back the longer of the two so it would be?
I'd cut them both. Yeah, I'd cut those both back. And that's just for, those aren't going to do
vertical it. Cuts, I mean, cut vertical up and down, perpendicular to the ground.
Correct.
Would be a good way to do it. And that way rain wouldn't stand on it. And if anything did break through and grow, you could see it.
Yes. Also monitor those cuts for borers. The borers will commonly get into open cuts like that, and which if that happens, we can chat about it. There's a polyphagous borer that's common in is infesting in Southern California. I don't know what species this is actually, it's an oak, but it's affecting some species of oaks and not others. That's something to learn about from your local cooperative extension folks, but just look at it periodically and, see if something's tunneling in there. Your local pest control service might have a product that will help take care of that. But again, I would consider this part of the final life of the tree. So I
hear what you're saying, Don, and I think that's wonderful. But I do have a question. If I were to, say, come across a tree that had fallen over and had started to resprout, and it had a whole bunch of little sprouts coming up, and I got something 2 feet tall. Could I cut that new growth off and root it and then have a new tree, or does that not work that way?
Oaks, I don't think, root all that readily. That would be the purpose of doing that, would be to have a clone of this exact tree. If it had some value, you would be taking cuttings of it. Oaks are generally not grown from cuttings, but not I don't know, actually, the answer to your question. If I were testing it, I would do semi-hardwood cuttings, because for most home gardeners, that's the way to go. They're just, it's easier for unless you have a greenhouse or a mist bench or something like that. So that's after they've flushed out and done some growth, and it's gone from soft green wood, which nursery growers can use, to semi-hardwood, which just doesn't dry out as quickly. You could certainly try that. And that would be an interesting way to conserve that particular tree. Generally, oaks are grown from acorns. Many trees that you buy are grafted. Many trees that you buy are grown from cuttings. Many trees are grown from seed. And there's usually a reason, usually the reason being that it doesn't work the other ways. And my guess is it probably would not root. But you know what? I would try it. If it does sprout, I would certainly, and there's a bunch of sprouts and you're only saving one of them to try and let it be a tree for a few more years while your baby tree grows up, I'd try it. And semi-hardwood cuttings are generally done May to June in this area, and actually down there as well. So that's worth
it. It'll be 2026. Once it sprouts, it'll be 2026 before you try to
No. What I mean is that you semi-hardwood is the same season. So when a shoot comes up on a woody plant and it's soft and green, it's pretty easy to propagate if you've got a greenhouse and a mist bench and all that kind of thing. If you don't have those things, some green cuttings just dry out too quickly. So we generally recommend, when someone says, I want to grow, I don't know, forsythia, some random thing that's a woody plant, for home gardeners, semi-hardwood typically still has root initials that will sprout on many species at least, and it doesn't dry out as quickly. So as a home gardener, that's what we usually recommend. And that's usually May to June of the same year when it comes up and then has done its big surge of growth and has started to get a little woody. We call it a semi-hardwood cutting. Dip it in hormone, keep it as high humidity around the shoot as you can. But the only reason for doing that would be to have an exact clone of this tree. And I don't know that that's necessary in this case, but you know what? I'd try it just for fun.
Yeah. And, I think it's the sort of situation where Aunt Fran gave you a rose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That situation. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Sorry about your tree. I really hate, I hate to see an older tree go down like this. You do need to clean up those cuts a bit, and you can certainly do that and leave what's there and see what happens in terms of it resprouting. I mean, I'll have to say, totally different direction. I plant a lot of trees on my farm, over 1,000 at this point. And some of them, I'm in a really windy zone, and some of them have blown down. And when a tree blows over a couple of times, I realize that's simply not a stable plant and I should probably take it out. Well, I had a particular type of cypress, Darjeeling cypress, which is I was just curious about it. So I planted three of them, and they grew 5 to 7 feet each the first year, two, three that they were growing. Now, that's a little too fast, honestly, but I was thrilled. I thought they were doing great. Then we had an epic windstorm here several years ago, and they all blew down from one direction. So I pulled them back upright and tried to stake them. And before I could get around to properly staking them, we got an epic windstorm from the other direction, and they all blew down again. And okay, so I thought,
that
all right.
That ripped out both roots from both sides. That's
roots
not
are definitely not stable. So I thought, I don't really care about this little corner. I'm just going to take these three trees that were in a triangular pattern and leave them on the ground, sort of stack them on each other in a triangle, and just see
with some roots connected still.
Yeah, some of the roots were still connected. I thought, if this, it's not a dangerous place, there's no risk. And so what happened was they sprouted at practically every node along the branch and formed this triangular hedge of this Darjeeling cypress. And now
your wolf loves it.
Yeah, the fox thinks it's great. They have sprouted vigorously, and they're stabilizing each other, apparently, because we've had some real windstorms since then. So no, I don't recommend this approach, but it's something that I was able to do in a place where these trees would not be a risk to anybody, and I didn't really care that much about it. They will. Many plants will resprout. You never really know whether there's growth buds down there ready to go. And so I now have a Darjeeling cypress grove. It's about 25 feet tall after 7 or 8 years, and they're stabilizing each other. If I went in to try and thin them out, I don't want to touch them at this point. I'm afraid to do any pruning. I'm afraid if I prune anything, I'll unbalance that wind strength that I've inadvertently created. So you never know. Sometimes things sprout very readily and you can work with something. Many plants, as they get older, the bark covers over the growth buds and prevents them from sprouting. So you really won't know until you've been through a growing season.
Yeah. When you do something like what you did with your cypress, did you just let it fall over, or did you actually put some dirt on the bottom so that maybe some roots are coming out the bottom?
I don't want to cover stem or roots with soil because of the risk of Phytophthora. So I just left them as they were. I did carefully stack them into a neat triangle. They had fallen a little sloppily. So I straightened it out a little bit. But no, I don't bury it over. And I had no idea what was going to happen. It turned out to work in this particular case. I mean, here's the thing. Trees don't always follow the rules. We were talking about this recently on a committee. There's a couple of trees that are in Davis. And when I took arboriculture from Dr. Harris many years ago, he took us on a bike tour and we looked at normal trees. And he took us to see both of these trees. And they're both still in Davis 40 plus years later. One of them is a sycamore and one of them is a cork oak. They went up and they went over back down to the ground. And they went back up. Each one of them had done this thing where they'd sort of fallen over after growing up and then gone back up. And in both cases, the owner left it that way. So they're what we would call serpentine in the business. And you can find one of them in the downtown area, one of them over on 8th Street. The cork oak is quite visible as you drive by 40 years later, perfectly stable, perfectly safe. I assume they're having it looked at periodically by a tree service, but it didn't follow the rules. It doesn't follow the exact structure and so forth. And so they just went ahead and left it as it is, as an interesting front yard novelty. Not every tree has to be exactly staked or trained the way we learn to do it when we take our arboriculture classes, but the key is to make sure it's not unsafe. And I'm concerned that a new shoot coming up on this particular case might be unsafe. With my cypresses, it didn't really matter. They blow down, they're out there, you know, there's nothing nearby. But this is right near a sidewalk in a busy street. So I'm concerned about the long-term viability of anything that might sprout. And I know that a new tree planted nearby will get special attention because these people obviously care about their trees. And the old tree can give it a little nurturing, sheltering it from wind and so forth as it gets going.
So please write back and let us know what happened. Now that was the email came in February 29th. So my guess is that something's already been done.
Yep, possibly. Although it's only been a week. So maybe they're they're waiting for our call. There you go. All right, let's move on here.
All right. So the next thing I have here is Don sent me a link to a newsletter or a magazine called Permaculture Design Course with Jeff Lawton. And one of the articles, it's talking about food production here. It says the sisterhood tradition, three sisters companion planting. Now, you may all have heard about corn, beans, and squash. I mean, I certainly heard about that when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And they're talking about what it is, how to do it, all this stuff. And then we come down to this paragraph. May I read this, Don?
Yeah, first of all, three sisters is the tradition of planting, as you mentioned, corn. Then that makes a pole for the beans, which climb on the corn and fix nitrogen for the corn, which likes high nitrogen. And this is done originally in very arid regions where rainfall is intermittent, as American Southwest in particular, for example. And so they do it in sort of a low depression area where the water will collect when it rains. And then to shade the roots, they plant some kind of a squash or pumpkin or melon or something like that. So that's the traditional combination. And I love this article because it has one very important caveat. Go ahead.
This layout works great for growing dry corn and dry beans.
Yeah.
If, however, you'd like to grow sweet corn and snap beans, you should consider an alternative. When growing dry corn and beans, everything is ready for harvest at the same time, but fresh corn and fresh beans will be ready before the squash will be. You're probably not going to want to carefully step around your pumpkins or watermelons every time you harvest beans or corns, and the squash leaves probably won't appreciate being stepped on either. In this case, an alternative layout is best. Rows of corns with beans planted in between is a great two-sister variation with the option to plant some squash along one side.
This is great. This is what I love to see is actually a pragmatic conversation on a permaculture site. Permaculture is an interesting philosophy, and I urge you all to learn about it. But people ask about this all the time, and I want to explain something. Sweet corn is a modern phenomenon. We did not have sweet corn in the 19th century. People have been doing the Three Sisters planting technique for 600 or 700 years. They're growing corn for drying, a staple part of their diet. And I've grown field corn. Well, I didn't, but the farmer who leased from us grew field corn. If you've ever eaten it, it's pretty starchy. It's
process it a lot.
Yeah,
it's like with the dry beans. It's their winter food. It's not something you're going to eat fresh.
Right, and you're going to grind it. When we first bought our farm, we leased back to the farmer, and he grew field corn around us, which we have very rich soil. It got 10, 12 feet tall. It was quite beautiful. They let it dry completely in the field. It was a little nerve-wracking. It's kind of a fire hazard, but it was great for wildlife. They let it dry completely in the field. It's rustling. We couldn't even hear the freeway, and it's only, 1,000 feet away. It's rustling in the corn. They wait till the corn itself has gotten down to almost dry enough to store, and then they come in, they harvest the whole thing. And by the way, when they did harvest the whole 13 acres, he went in a circular pattern into the middle, and as he hit the last part of it, he said a couple dozen pheasants went running out in all directions. It's great, great habitat for field birds. You're not going in there and picking sweet corn, and you're not going in there and picking green beans. You're waiting until the end of the season when they're dried for shelling in the case of the beans, for grinding in the case of the corn. And the squash you're growing is typically going to be a storage or keeper type squash, something that you would be picking in October, which is when the corn and the beans would be ready, at the same time. If you've ever walked through squash, pumpkins, or melons in shorts, it's very scratchy and uncomfortable. Yes. So this is for growing storage type of summer vegetables, if you want to call them that. These are actually more like grains, things you can use right on through the winter. Excellent caveat, and I really wanted to put that out there. A fun thing to do. I've seen studies where people have tested the yield data from Three Sisters technique versus, standard agricultural practices. And I really think that the alternating sweet corn and beans is a great way to go, because the beans are building the soil. Corn is an excellent cover crop for crowding out weeds. The roots are aggressive. So you cut off the corn and the roots will practically plow your soil for you. And then they'll just break down after you cut the plant down. You can use the stems of corn comparable to straw. It's an excellent mulch for the garden. But really, again, if you're using it for corn on the cob type of corn, then you should in alternating rows with whatever kind of beans you're growing. It's okay to have green beans climbing up onto corn. That's no problem. Might make it kind of a tangle out there as you go out to harvest. But I really do think that the Three Sisters technique, you need to understand that it predates modern sweet corn, and for that matter, really modern snap beans. It's mainly used for the purpose of these storage versions of those vegetables.
In the 70s, when I was here in college, the Three Sisters were not only a growth technique, but they were being touted as a complete meal.
Sure.
In other words, that the proteins and the starches and all that stuff in those three things eaten together was very healthy and very nutritious.
They continue with
what
a little.
Didn't think about was how these were actually used in ancient times. They were dried. Mm-hmm. They were winter crops. These were not, corn on the cob with some baked beans kind of thing. So.
Also, I'd point out, if you're growing popcorn, it would fit great in this, because popcorn is handled much like field corn. You have to let it dry on the plant. Now, in terms of how you set this up, it really depends on your area. And I do think this comment they make is great. The Iroquois planted their Three Sisters gardens in a mound of soil about 4 feet across and 1 foot high. This is good for wetter climates. In drier climates, a small crater can be added to the top of the mound, or even plant the whole garden in a depression. So a lot of the places like New Mexico and Arizona, I've never gardened there, but I've traveled through there, and you get rain in the summer, but you don't know when it's going to happen, and you can go weeks without it and then get a whole bunch all at once. And so this would be a way to concentrate the runoff, the rainfall, when it does come, have it soak in where you need it. So really, it's going to depend on where you are. Three Sisters technique has been used in a lot of native plantings over centuries. But you're going to want to adapt it to wherever you're listening. Centuries old tradition of balance and cooperation that has stood the test of time for a reason, but here is a reasonable discussion of how to actually do it. And so the site was, what is the name of this? You got it in front of you there?
I just closed it, I'm sorry.
I got it right here. The Permaculture Research Institute. And you can head there, just Google that, and you'll find the Sisterhood Tradition, Three Sisters Companion Planting. Companion planting in general is a lot of lore and not a lot of evidence. if you want to take a real basic principle from companion planting, it is diversity in your garden is a good thing in every way. Having flowers nearby your vegetables is great for pollination, for drawing in beneficials and so forth. The very specific charts you see of companion planting, if I could be charitable, are complete bunk. But the whole idea is fine, that you have lots of different stuff out there. You have lots of diversity. No, beans and tomatoes don't care about each other, but you do have a benefit of planting cosmos on the edge of your garden because it draws, you know, syrphid flies and their larvae eat aphids. That's the kind of companion planting that really has some evidentiary basis.
Well, we have lots of mail coming in, and if you would like to send us a message and brag about something that's happening or ask a question or whatever, send it to
davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
All right. Here we go. This is Annie, and I'm trying to see where she's from. Don't see it. Attached is a picture of a formerly 6-inch wide puppy.
Yeah.
Whatever is eating it, it has also devoured 6 others. Ooh. At first, I thought it was white-crowned sparrows, so I covered it with chicken wire. But even when covered, they have been eaten down past the ribs of the plants. These poppies are not cheap, but they are absolutely gorgeous. They're from Annie's Annuals in Richmond.
Yep.
What do you think could be eating them, and what do I do about it? Last year, I had 3 stunning plants, and now I only have, 1.5 sort of leftovers.
Well, good news.
Thanks, as always, for your wonderful, informative, and entertaining show. I have learned so much from you. Please help me save my remaining poppies from a very hungry whatever it is.
And then
she sends a picture, and I can't tell what kind of poppy this is. Can you tell?
Not from the picture, no, but I do see a growing point in the center. So there's a good chance your plant will resprout if you figure out what is eating it. And once again, I highly recommend the Midnight Slug Patrols because you'll find out if that is your problem. With the moist weather we've been having and the temperatures bumping up to 40 degrees and up, snails and slugs are going to be out in force. And of course, they're out at night. So you won't see them during the daytime. Yes, white-crowned sparrows do love poppy plants, but since you've screened it off and the damage is continuing, evidently it's not them. So my best guess is that you're dealing with slugs, which do typically start, at least in my experience, on the outer leaves and the tender new leaves, but they, if you're lucky and they haven't gotten the central growing point of the plant, it can recover. I would suggest going out with a flashlight, and I do this almost every night just to see what's going on out there, see if any snails or particularly slugs are coming out and have eaten off the foliage there. There's a lot of different ways you can deal with slugs. Of course, hand picking while you're out there is one simple way. I got paid a penny for every 2 snails when I was a kid. Okay. My mother would hand me a milk carton that she had opened the top to, and I could go out in coastal San Diego. I could make pretty good money picking snails. And when I filled it up, no, she didn't count them. She just estimated. And then she would dispatch them by any of her various techniques for doing that. You could find an amazing number out there at night. And if you went out during the daytime, you wouldn't find even the snails typically, unless you kind of found the nearby vegetation and poked away down into it, find them harboring in there during the daytime. They do come out at night. Our experience there was that crinum lilies, daylilies, agapanthus, which is in practically every landscape in California, were breeding grounds for the snails, which would then, and slugs, which would then come out at night and head over and feed on any seedlings that went out. When I was a gardener in San Diego, there were some plants I simply could not grow because the snail problem was so common and severe, even hand picking a lot of them. So go out at night first and see what's out there. There's a variety of ways you can dispatch snails and slugs. You can pay a kid. The inflation rate, I'd go 2 cents per snail these days. But you can also put out beer. You've heard about that. Yes, it works. It doesn't have to have alcohol. It's just the smell of the yeast that draws them. And you have a number of things put out in bowls will actually draw them. Yeast is particularly effective. And so if you don't happen to have beer on hand, you can just sprinkle a little yeast in there. If the smell apparently draws them in, they get up there, they slip in and they drown. You can use it for monitoring. If you don't feel like going out at night, put the bowl of beer out at, you know, dusk and then check it in the morning. And if you find even a couple of slugs in there, that's probably your problem. Earwigs are going to be showing up in April typically here, but their damage is more nibbling, although a lot of nibbling, not the whole leaf gone, just a lot of damage along the edges of the leaf. And when you go out at night, you'd be sort of horrified to find a single plant with as many as a dozen or more earwigs on it. They're very attracted to the smell of oil. So oil traps have been used for monitoring and actually give a really good level of control with earwigs. Any kind of oil, a film of it, you know, just a quarter inch in the bottom of a bowl. This is one case where people often use paper bowls so they can dispose of them afterwards. I have found peanut oil works particularly well. And the more aromatic, the better. So your light safflower oil, no, you want that strong olive oil or that peanut oil or something that has a distinctive smell to it. And they smell it and they, same thing, they crawl in there and they drown. And during earwig season, you may find 10 or 20 of them in there in the morning. So that tells you that that was your problem. And you've killed a lot of them, but there's probably more that you didn't kill. You can pinch and kill an earwig. I would wear gloves while doing it as you go out at night. They're kind of gross and they have those pincher things on the back, but the oil traps can be a way to monitor for earwigs and the beer traps can be a way to monitor for snails and slugs, particularly slugs.
So I have heard an additional thing, which is to have a bowl of water, which mm-hmm. is deep enough to kill the snails and slugs, but float a little bit of oil on it to give that smell and attract things to it.
Yeah.
Is that a myth or is that a possibility?
No, anything that smells will draw them in. I've always heard yeast is more effective, and yeast is certainly in beer, and you can buy, you know, beer very cheap. So that's what a lot of people use, and that's been around for a long time. Now, having said all that, there are baits that you can use for snails and slugs, and there's a very low toxicity one out there based on iron phosphate. Sluggo is one of the brands. There's a couple others that are based on, it's just iron and phosphorus. Breaks down into fertilizer as it disintegrates. Our experience with it is it any rain or even heavy dew causes it to start disintegrating, so you have to keep applying it. But it does not have an insecticide in it. The old snail baits were metaldehyde based. You're a real risk with pets. They're still out there, but I really don't recommend them at all. So look for the ones that are iron phosphate based, and Sluggo is the best known brand. Sluggo also has one that has a organic insecticide in it that's called Sluggo Plus. It works for earwigs, but the insecticide, although organic, it's an insecticide and it has some toxicity. So if you've got pets, you might be concerned about using that one. I suggest monitoring first or going out with a flashlight and seeing what's exactly going on. Now, I say this to people, and sometimes they're in like a community garden. So they're not going to be going down there at midnight with a flashlight. Probably not what they want to be doing. That's where the monitoring with these bowls of oil and water, and oil in the case of earwigs, beer or something like it in the case of slugs and snails, can be effective. The other thing is to note the nearby plants, because that if you are using the bait, iron phosphate type bait like Sluggo, you might as well put it over there. I mean, if you've got agapanthus in your yard, that's where they're breeding. Just put a little line of it right there, and that will probably give you some level of control. People are often surprised at how far snails and slugs will climb for a good meal. They are quite motivated, and they really like tender young seedlings. So generally the time that I really find there's a concern, most damage, is right after planting for about 7 to 10 days, when you should monitor carefully, use a bait if it's appropriate, use a trap if it's appropriate. But almost surely what you're seeing there is damage from mollusks, which are snails and slugs.
So if you're planning on putting out a bowl of something, whatever it is, and mm-hmm. you want something little to crawl into it, mm-hmm. I would not recommend using a regular old cereal bowl, because they would have to go into the bottom and then upside down back
oh, they
up
will.
To the edge to get to the lip. So you they know,
will.
The easiest,
no,
I know they will, but Don, the easiest thing,
okay.
go to the dollar store and buy one of those pet watering dishes that okay. it goes to the ground on the outside and then yeah. it goes up as a slope and it's got a, and it's, you know,
make it easier. Make it easier for them. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. And if you want to put a paper bowl in it and paper plate in it, that would work too.
But the right. nighttime monitoring with a flashlight is really important for this, because most of the things you're dealing with are feeding at night. So whether it's earwigs, snails, or slugs. Now, slugs harbor under things. So snails are usually down in the foliage of some overgrown plant nearby. Slugs will harbor on the bottom of a pot, under yes. firewood. If you have a piece of plywood on the ground, you lift it up, you're almost sure to find slugs underneath it. So they'll be closer into where the damage is typically than snails. Snails, of course, have that protective shell, so they can crawl an amazing distance to feed. Slugs tend to be closer to where they're feeding.
Okay, so let's go on to our next writer. And this is from here in Irvine, California, mm-hmm. Zone 10. Hi, Lois and Don. Hope you are both doing well. I thought I'd take a page from a recent letter that was read out and send a question in directly to Lois.
There you go.
But of course, we would also love Don's advice and experience as well. I have an annoying problem with slugs for the last 2 years. It's much better this year. And I don't know if that's due to me diligently going out a few nights with a headlamp, gloves, and a plastic cup with water and salt.
There you go. Yep.
Picking off a couple of hundred slugs. Or if it's the rain patterns that is doing this or something else. My question was, are there specific things you would recommend I do to attract the kind of birds that will eat slugs? Hmm. I do already get a lot of birds in my yard, not sure what kind they are, but a lot of hummingbirds for sure, and a bunch of others too. As you might have guessed, I'm not good at identifying birds. I also grow a lot of veggies and fruit, like tomatoes, peas, beans, brassicas, stone fruit, and more. So I don't want to unnecessarily attract the kind of birds that will eat my produce, not eat my slugs. So I get that I don't really have a lot of agency.
That's anyway, correct.
Yeah. And advice would be more than welcome. Thank you and have a great day.
Do any birds eat slugs, Lois?
So Don, let me answer the question.
Yeah.
So you have hummingbirds in your yard. This is wonderful. I'm so glad for you. Hummingbirds eat nectar. Mm-hmm. And that's why they go to the flowers to get the nectar. If you have a hummingbird feeder, you'll watch them a lot. They also eat protein when they have families, because you need to carry it back to the babies and carrying drops of fluid doesn't work real well. So they all eat little tiny, tiny, tiny insects, little spiders or little flying insects, that sort of thing. Okay, then you have a bunch of little birds in your yard. Now, the hummingbirds aren't going to do anything for your slug situation. And then you have the little tiny warblers and songbirds, and they're eating things like aphids, little tiny spiders, little bitty insects, that sort of thing. Then we come to the next larger things, and those are the ones that eat seed. Now, in the wintertime, we have a lot of white crowned sparrows, golden crowned sparrows, juncos that are sit on the ground and eating seeds that have fallen on the ground. There's also doves that'll do that and that sort of thing. And then the bigger birds or the bigger food would be things like scrub jays, mockingbirds. Scrub jays love to eat peanuts and walnuts and acorns and big honking things, but vegetables. They're not much into slugs. The bigger bird, well, then of course we have the carnivores or birdivores, the hawks and things that fly by. They're not going to go just that. So the only birds that I can think of that actually like to eat slugs and snails are ducks. Mm. If you lived on a farm and you had ducks, they would be in there flipping over stuff and looking for the slugs and snails.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that.
No, it's not something you want to have in your house at your residential area, especially not with all of the vegetables that you're growing, because ducks would love to eat all those little vegetables too. So I'm sorry to tell you that birds are not your solution.
We had ducks when I was growing up. We had ducks in our yard in coastal San Diego in a normal residential setting. I learned 50 years later, many of my neighbors, when we found each other on Facebook, remembered our ducks. My father and mother raised them. They love to eat snails and slugs. You keep them in their own place because they're the messiest bird you've ever had. They're gross, and they will, yes, they'll devastate the vegetable garden. But if you do happen to have a duck or two, and you happen to be out paying your little kid to gather snails for a penny for every two, when you get them, one of the things my mother would do with them was just throw them in where the ducks were. And although it's gross to watch, they love to eat snails and slugs. So yes, they work. It would only be for those, I think, who are perhaps rural properties, but they definitely will eat them. I just wouldn't let them go in where the snails and slugs are for the reasons both Lois and I have iterated here. Beyond that, all the birds you mentioned are out in the daytime, right?
And well, yeah.
And slugs are out at night. So that would be the primary issue right there.
Well, the only birds that are going to come out at night are carnivores.
Yeah.
So the owls will be out hunting mice, but that's not going to do any good.
No,
if you ever wonder what a bird eats, let's say you've got a little bird in your backyard and it's got a nice black pompadour top and it's got some white underneath down the belly and it's going cheep, shoot, shoot. and it's flying around in your backyard. And so look at the beak.
Yeah, there you go.
That is a black phoebe, and it is a flycatcher. And the beak is very small compared to, say, a mockingbird or something like that.
Or a duck.
And it has little feathery whiskery feathers, whatever, beside the bill. So as it's flying through the air, it can feel where the flying insect is to get it.
Imagine it trying to eat a slug. That would be a real challenge. Yeah. Yes.
So look at the beak, and it'll give you a clue as to what the bird eats.
Big old flat beak smashes the snail in a rather revolting manner, and they just gulp it right on down. So now, what does eat slugs and snails? Some of the animals that come through your garden at night. Skunks eat snails. Mm-hmm. And skunks in your garden are fine. You don't have any reason to be concerned about them, except you should move slowly if you happen upon one. Much experience with that myself. Possums will eat slugs and snails, and they would be out at night when these things are crawling around. So they're encouraging and allowing. Every now and then on social media sites like Nextdoor, someone will say, I have a skunk coming into my backyard. What do I do about it? I said, well, nothing. Just stay out of the backyard when the skunk is there. They're doing lots of great things in your yard, and they're feeding on things that are harmful in your garden. They definitely feed on snails and slugs, and possums will likewise. The main problem you have is that all the birds would be out, as we said, in the daytime, and snails and slugs are hiding in the daytime and will come out at night. So you'd need something that's feeding then. And the animals that are out there are those ones that I just mentioned. We've also talked about other techniques for monitoring them. And I think that, yes, you're probably seeing an effect of the rainfall pattern. The growing up and gardening in coastal San Diego, slugs were a year-round problem for me. Part of it was that I had a huge patch of crinum lilies. They were breeding in there by the hundreds, if not thousands. And so any day of the year with the fog that's classic in Southern California, you know, it's damp all the way till early afternoon, overcast a lot of the time. It's year round for folks down in those climates and coastal zones in California. Here in the valley, we're fortunate that slugs and snails tend to be very seasonal. They're a problem in the spring when you're first putting out garden plants. They're a problem in the fall when it first starts to rain. We don't get to the dew point from about May through October here. So they go into, their population drops way, way, way down. They're rarely a significant problem once we get into the warmer, drier season here in the interior. But in coastal areas, they can be a year-round problem. Try to find where they're harboring, where they're breeding. That was my effective approach to snails in the coastal zone. We had this giant bed of crinum lilies. If you're familiar with them, they're a great big fleshy thing. And this bed was like 10 by 15. They were spectacular when they were in bloom. I began to realize thousands of snails and slugs were coming out of that bed every night. And about every year, I adopted a technique. You can do this with your agapanthus if you want to try that as well. I would take a scythe or a machete or a sickle, and I would cut all that vegetation to the ground. I mean, completely after the bloom, which is in May to June, I would cut these completely to the ground. I'd pick up all that gloppy vegetation stuff and throw it in my dad's compost pile. And on the ground would be 1,000 snails just lying there waiting for me to rake them up and throw them into the duck enclosure. That worked fine. I would get a reset of the population. And then the crinums would grow and the population would build up again, and they would go on for a while. But it was one way that I could manage it to some degree. Interior valley gardeners, it's not as much of a problem for us, more of a problem, unfortunately, at that time when you're just putting out those summer seedlings. So you'll find the baits do work. These very low toxicity, safe baits that are actually technically organic in the case of sluggo, or you can monitor for them. But like you're doing late at night with a plastic cup with water and salt in it, it's a time-tested technique for dealing with snails and slugs. You've been listening to The Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.